Hi everyone, welcome back to another episode of Enablement Evolved. Today I have an enablement powerhouse on with me, someone who's been in enablement since probably before it was called enablement. And just to give you a little flavour before I hand over to them of the sort of positions this person's held, been in enablement for 15 some odd years, has held roles such as the head of enablement at Vantage, previously was the VP of enablement at Instructure. Up until January of this year, was the president of the Revenue Enablement Society and is currently the founder of Revenue Flywheel Group. And if that wasn't enough, he also has a book coming out later this year. Paul Butterfield, how the bloody hell are you?
Hey, Kieran. Good to see you, mate.
So I gave a very bullet list type of your background. Would you mind, like, for those of who are foolish enough not to know who you are and have been living under an enablement rock for however long enablement's been a thing, do you mind giving us a little bit of your background and what brought you to Revenue Flywheel Group and maybe a little bit of overview of the book, even if the title's still a bit of a secret?
Sure. And to be fair, the title's not a secret. We just haven't settled yet. So,
I was trying to protect that
no secrets. It's a secret to me as well, right? We got a working title. That's it. Anyway, but the so the you know, my story is probably like a number of folks where I grew up in sales, and in my case, I was, you know, I got into tech sales with HP. Got into my first tech sales leadership job with HP, then moved on to other companies like Microsoft and Intuit, et cetera. But I was at a company called InContact, which has since been acquired. But we were a public, we called CCaaS, Contact Center as a Service. And CCaaS, we'd have to usually educate any prospect what that was, because contact centers in the cloud in 2011, when I started there, were not well known yet, right? But I'd been there about half my time there, and we had a swap in leadership. The EVP who'd hired me moved on to be CRO somewhere else, and they brought in a new guy. And the new guy was, I think he'd been there about 3 months. I walked in, I remember this though, September 2012. Friday mornings were my one-on-ones with Bill. So being halfway through the third month of the quarter, I walk in loaded with facts and figures, right? Ready to just do the whole pipeline forecast thing. And I'm sure we did some of it, but I don't remember. What I remember is at one point he got up from his desk and he walked to his whiteboard and he wrote out the words sales enablement. And in September of 12, I hadn't heard that term, didn't know what it was, never heard of it. Had to go Google it later, but I just nodded as if I knew and listened to him. And he talked about, you know, his research into it, and he acknowledged it was a relatively new field. He what he'd learned and what the outcomes were that he wanted and why he wanted it in his org. And his primary reason, Kieran, was as a new EVP, his mandate from the board was to take us from about 225 million, which is where we were, US, to 500. And he reckoned he could do it in about 3 years. But he didn't reckon he could do it if he didn't have enablement, because he was going to be growing the sales team by leaps and bounds and doing all sorts of things without training and support. So he sent me home for the weekend, asked me to think on it, and to come back Monday with an answer. And if the answer was yes, with a big wink, clearly he'd made up his mind. He said, then give me a high level 30, 60, 90. And the reason that he picked me out of his sales leadership team is he said that he'd observed how I was developing my team. At the time, our company didn't do any professional development for employees, regardless of what department you were in. And so as a sales leader, I had a problem with that. Number one, I believe as leaders, and you and I have talked, I know this is your point of view as well. As leaders, we have a moral obligation to help our people become their best work selves, at least. But number two, selfishly, I had a number to hit. And so if HR or whoever weren't going to train my people, I had to do it. And that's why he had chosen me, because he's like, look, what you do, you need to figure out how to scale it, but your instincts are solid. Anyway, so here we are. And so
Love.
that's how I went and did. I came back and I told him yes, and turned out had a lot of fun doing it.
And that wink had nothing to do with the yes, did it? It had nothing at all
Oh,
to
nothing at all. No, he hadn't made up his mind at all. It was totally my decision. No,
do.
I mean, I'm sure that it was my decision, but he clearly, and again, he was new, so we were all still getting to know him. And you
Of
know, what I
course.
learned over time is by the time Bill came to you with something, he'd thought about it deeply, and you probably ought to as well. So,
And before we jump, we've got quite an interesting topic to discover, which is part of obviously what you do at Revenue Flywheel Group. But I know we don't have the title, but with regards to the book, you'd expect it to be out roughly in the fall time.
Yeah, we're targeting the fall. I'm not trying to get all the printing and stuff done myself. So I'm working with a publisher, and so I'm a little bit tied to their timetable. But the idea is, it's not a vanity project. I just want to be clear on that, right? I do feel that I've learned through trial and error, if nothing else, and I do share what I've learned and what I've seen work in the field and whatnot. But I also am conscious of the fact that there are so many people out there doing it and doing it in different ways and getting the same or better results. And so what I'm trying to do is incorporate some of the others that I know and how they're doing things. So the overall book is my framework. But I want to share lots of examples of different ways that people are accomplishing it, because there's not just one right way to do enablement. You do need to, and I think you're not going to get into this, there need to be certain elements that are in every successful enablement program, but there's lots of ways to get to those elements. So the book will be written for enablement people. I hope some of them will read it and give me their feedback. But I'm trying to write it just as much for people that are outside of enablement who, frankly, still find it a bit confusing. Is it sales enablement? Is it revenue enablement? Is it GTM enablement? And you talk to them as well. And so this is somewhat for them also, that you could read this and understand, oh, okay, that's a framework of enablement I can get my head around. That's why it works. That's why it's like Jenga, and you don't want to be pulling out random bits because you don't know, right, which ones are going to cause a collapse, that sort of thing. That's my goal. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah. Well, I don't think, will we ever get to a one definition of what is enablement? No. But if we can get a sort of common thought process, that'd be a real help.
Yeah, right. Right. So. And what are the objectives of it? Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's certainly a good starting place for any conversation to go. So, Paul, you're the founder of Revenue Flywheel Group. And one of the things that you sort of preach there is something called customer journey enablement. Now, we've heard a lot about people enablement, sales enablement, revenue enablement, but I know the part of your framework is the customer journey enablement. But for those who maybe haven't heard it, what is that? And how does it differ from the traditional definition of enablement?
Well, to your point a minute ago, there is no traditional definition of enablement. However, it's a phrase that I hit on sometime over the last whatever years, again, in my communications with the executive leaders that I was responsible to and reported to, with prospective clients that I would talk to help them be able to visualize more easily the kind of enablement structure or ecosystem that I was envisioning for them. Because then we could step out of the other terms, right? Which again, outside of enablement, people are confused by that. And that's not just me. If you talk to Peter Ostrow, some of the others who spend their days researching this stuff, there's still just genuine confusion outside of the enablement world. Yeah. But all I meant by customer journey, it's a fancy way of saying what I know a lot of people are listening, are probably doing, or are building if they're not already doing. And that is, if we only enable the sales team, yeah, that'll make a difference. That'll make a difference. If we do it well, it'll make a difference to their pocketbooks. It'll make a difference to the success of the organization, stock price, all of those things, because we've got to be able to show that reasonable, consistent correlation back to more success for sales. And more success for sales is a very binary thing. It's more dollars. Either you're going up or you're going down. However, if we only focus on the sales team, we miss an opportunity. Because if we bring alignment to from product through product marketing, field marketing, SDRs, sales, implementation, professional services, customer success, renewals team, if we're bringing a common language, if we're bringing a common outside in point of view, if we bring an approach that we're saying, look, stop trying to sell so hard and listen more and diagnose and understand, right? The sales will come if you do that. That then creates a very different sort of environment. And in my experience, actually, in fact, the highest achievement that enablement teams can achieve is this, that the organization they support is differentiating themselves through how they sell and through the customer experience just as much, if not more, than their product and what it does. That to me is it's something that can be done, but you've got to work across all go-to-market teams, customer interacting teams, whatever you want to call them, to get that. And that's where the name of the company came from, right? It's that flywheel effect that comes from Jim Collins' book, you know, good to great. Good book, still relevant, although it's getting kind of old. But when you align a lot of potentially looking these small things, they look like small things, though, across those groups, you create a sum that's greater than the parts. And that's now that I'm out on my own, when I launched the company, that's what I wanted people to catch the vision. This is what we're trying to do. So customer journey enablement was something I was surprised that in the US, nobody had trademarked it. So I did. And so that's when it became officially part of our company brand. So
love that.
But it might be available in the UK, so go.
Yeah, I'll go straight on gold after this. But it was so much gold in there, and there's a couple of things that you saw me nodding my head away there. I think the first thing that sticks out to me is I couldn't agree more with the, yes, you can move facts and figures in the binary bit, but you know that difference in how you sell and just how you're different. Mm-hmm. Like that's, I've always said that, like, since I got into enablement, that's what I would love my legacy to be. You know, when you build such a good onboarding and enablement program, mm-hmm. that people look at any salesperson that came from that company and go, they're good sellers, right? Because I know it has been through this. So I worked for a company called Yale. You guys have it in the US, like Yellow Pages, Yellow Book, right?
Oh, right. Yeah, of course.
So when I worked there, they were like, that was the first time I ever got real sales training. So it was 2 weeks residential, and then you were in like an incubator after that. But like genuinely for 10 years afterwards, recruiters would call me and be like, you worked for Yale, I want you for this job. Just because that's how well respected their sales training was. And literally I spoke to someone, put me in contact with someone the other day who's trying to move into enablement. The leveling of the playing field was, oh, you used to work at Yale as well. So instantly there's like that respect of, this person must know what they're talking about. And as I said, like, if you can create a go-to-market org like that, that's more than worth its weight in gold, right? And to your point, you can't do that by working just sales or just CS. That's got to be everybody, right?
Yeah. Now, you can't boil the ocean, so you've got to start somewhere. And I think for most of us, starting and building the core around sales is going to make the most sense. But because, again, you can't do it all at once. But to your point, I won't go into all the details, but one of the best untraditional hires I ever made, in fact, it was the last hire I made as a sales director before launching the enablement gig full-time for my boss. Guy who came with no tech experience, no SaaS experience, no contact center experience, yet what he had done is been a top seller for Yellow Pages in his district for 5 years running. And I reckoned that anybody that could go out and had the fire to sell something that really was a pure commodity, that has to be such a hard sale, and did well at it for 4 or 5 years, the rest is details. I'm happy to teach him the other stuff that he doesn't know, because I can't teach that to somebody. Yeah. And he had a fantastic run there for many years, rose up into the ranks of sales leadership, and most recently became a CRO at another company. So, there's all just a little pitch for, don't, you know, think outside the box. There are really good salespeople out there that don't necessarily come from your industry.
Absolutely. And there's a couple of other bits, but in the interest of us not labeling this point, I'll just go into one of them. But I think to your point about, yes, you of course have to start somewhere. But do you think, you know, we're looking at this flywheel effect and mm-hmm. having everybody, do you think that's also part of how the world of revenue orgs has changed? Obviously, you think 2 years ago it was all about gross pipeline generation, right? And you know how many new sales you're getting, growth, whereas that seems to have seesawed a little bit, right, to like net mm-hmm. revenue retention and customer mm-hmm. retention and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And we've seen, and I think that was a part of the, and you'll know better than me, but like the shift from going from sales enablement as a job title to revenue enablement, because the thing is, the entire world has changed, right? Like companies now are being valued on how many customers they keep, not how many they bring in the door, and that leaky bucket syndrome. So do you think that helps in terms of like when you're trying to get buy-in for not just working with the sales teams, but working with everyone else, the fact that the world has changed a little bit?
I do. I think that's a lot of it, in fact, because companies were forced to think differently. My own experience, it just came from the direct experience. Go back to that first role, right, when I was trying to figure out what enablement is. But I knew from having worked deals with my crew that we had a horrible handoff in many situations to implementation and ultimately CS, and too many deals didn't turn up because of that, right? You know, they got clawed back. Nobody likes that. I knew from experience that the way that I was trying to get my sellers to talk to their prospects, in other words, stop talking about product and features, start talking about what we, you know, talk about things in terms of verbs and how the prospect will use it, ask questions. I had Red Challenger sale and you know, and so there was some influence there as well. But if marketing is still only churning out bits about here's these features and here's a feature comparison battle card and all of that, my team wasn't going to write. They couldn't use that and do what I was asking them to do. So taking that experience is what got me to realize, and I did consolidate around sales initially. But once we had that, it said, look, we've rolled out this sales methodology. I went to the head of professionals or COO and professional services, CS, all reported to him. And I said, look, this is the difference we're making in sales with this methodology. Here's why I think you ought to invest in sending your people from CS through, because after that handoff, we're going to have better inputs for them. We're going to have better, and he got it, right? And so, So it was in fits and starts, but to me, it was just practical application. But fast forward to your point, that's 2013, 2014. Fast forward when companies start looking at it differently. When I was at Vonage, we worried a lot about customer retention. That was never, yes, growth as well, but our CS teams took quota. Now there was a cap to how much they would sell before it had to be handed off to sales. But their collective quota was almost as big as the mid-market North America's collective quota. So and if you're going to have, and there are other organizations where CS generate revenue. So if you're not enabling them, who is? How do they know how to do that?
100%. I've worked for companies in the past where they were so focused on sales that, and then CS didn't have a quota, but then it was like some figures where it was like only 6% of their total client base had more than one product. Now that's money just lying on the table, right?
Like
that's,
yeah, I mean, that's oh my gosh, statistic, waiting for right? someone else to come along. Yeah,
right, exactly that, right? And they wonder why they're losing to competitors or consolidating. But also then you look at the CS org and the CS org where the fluffy customer service rather than CSMs, but and then like the upsell would go, or the cross sell, they had upsell, cross sell, and some other with lots of different words for the same thing, but that was would then be bounced straight back to the salesperson. So again, the customer journey was not particularly good, right?
No, that's a good point. That's a really good point.
So to move on to someone with your experience, obviously you're going into lots of different companies now where with Revenue Flywheel, and I know that the main thing that you do there is transform sales or revenue orgs from where they are into becoming high performing and customer centric. So when you go into a new company, Paul, when you start working with them, how does, you know, taking them to some, what we define as customer centric, how does that differ to most of the sales orgs when you first walk in? And when you're looking at making that shift, what do you think are the two or three most common elements or skills that need to be addressed when you first start working with a new company?
I love that question. Thank you. So the first thing is when I'm listening and doing discovery, I'm really curious to see how do they refer to their own prospects and customers. Mm. How many times have you heard this? And just in the course of day-to-day conversation, where are they in our process? What stage are they in? There, I know that they're not taking an outside-in view, right?
Sure.
Because prospect couldn't care less about their process. And but at a higher level, you know, I always try to start with a revenue org assessment because just like we tell sellers, don't go in and start pitching something until you understand what the needs are and the gaps are. But then what... Here you talk about the skills. Here are things that I see consistently. Number one, sellers and BDRs do not have business acumen to have business conversations. Now, to be fair, they haven't been supported in it. To be fair, especially in SaaS, what they have been told to do is run this pitch deck and then open up a demo.
Yeah.
That is not discovery, right? And it's not the best use of someone's time on the first call. However, it's still very prevalent, isn't it? So if you're going to take that away from them, they have got to be able to walk in there. And no, we don't expect a 28-year-old AE to be at the same level as a senior director of fill in the blank. But they can be educated and enabled enough to carry their own in a conversation. And the benefit they do have, if that's one of their ICPs, is they talk to lots of people in that role. And they probably do bring insights that individual may not have just in their individual role. But that's the next thing that I find lacking, surprisingly, Kieran, and that is a well-defined ICP.
Oh, really?
Okay. Or if they do have, or they might call it a buying persona. Mm-hmm. And if they do have it, It's not in a in a way that sales can digest it and internalize it and really use it, right?
Right.
And so that's something that very common that we will work on doing is either creating or beefing up what those look like and then making sure that sales understands how to use it. I'll leave one other skill set, and that is managing multi-threading effectively. If you're in a very transactional account with a single buyer, no problems there. But most of us are not. Most of us are dealing with 3, 4, 7 decision makers through the process. So how good are the team at earning the right to access those people? And I use the word earning intentionally. It's more than just asking. You've got to show why that they should bring you in.
Yeah.
How good are they at running discovery and understanding what's going on in their world? And how well are they at maintaining deal velocity and managing the sales cycle? All skills that are critical that we find opportunity a lot to work on.
I love that. You know, business acumen is something I've probably complained about a lot, but if you ask me my top three, it probably wouldn't make it in just for I'd be thinking of other things. And I think I can, just when you were talking in there, I can think of lots of examples of like, and again, some of this comes from enablement, right? Where like maybe we give someone a call script and you've got a BDR, SDR, who's maybe 23, 24, and no disrespect to them, this is how they've been taught, but they might speak to a CTO or a VP of sales, like, I understand what it's like to do this. It's like, no, you don't, right? Like, and again, depending on who you're speaking to, that might put someone's back up right from there and be like, what do you mean you understand my life? Like, you don't, right? Don't pretend that you do. But again, you could just rephrase that, right? Depending on like who I speak to lots of or whatever it is.
And something I hear frequently is, nobody can argue with that.
And I think the other bit with the ICP, and I found this more and more as I've almost like lifted up the lid or like peeled back a few layers. And again, it's not necessarily the understanding of who they are, but it's understanding of what's important to that person. Like, you know, you have like above the line, below the line conversation.
Yep. Uh-huh.
I had it a lot when I was at Andela. You know, I'd have AEs and it would go on and speak to a CTO the same way they'd speak to a director of engineering, right? Because we did staff augmentation, right? And like, if you speak to a director of engineering about their team, they're worried about filling that seat today. If you speak to the CTO, they're thinking 18, 24 months down the line, market share price, projects, lose. Like, and again, but we would have some AEs who would go in and ask a CTO, you know, what's your average time to hire? And you'd see them looking around, like, why are you asking me that question, right? Like,
I have people for that.
Yeah, right? But you might only get one shot at talking to that person, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's almost like business acumen and buyer persona ICP combined, right?
It is.
But no, that's interesting. And
you get delegated to the person you sound the most like. So if you walk into the C-suite, you talk like an engineer.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
Yeah.
And the thing is, we had the same with SDRs. And they'd go in, because our thing was we wouldn't talk to talent acquisition. We'd talk to directors of engineering. But the first question that they would ask is, I see two vacancies on LinkedIn. So where you to that, you get bumped directly to who you sound like, right? You get bumped directly to the power for that question. So every time. So then I'm going, we need more objection handling. I was like, no, you need to ask a different opening question, right? Like, it's the context. But, no, I love that, because my default answer is always discovery / value is when I go into these things. But I think one of the things that you and I share a passion for, Paul, is tying enablement programs, whether it's sales or revenue enablement, to revenue and growth outcomes.
Yeah.
From your point of view, how can enablement teams help make that shift in terms of making everything strategic or / having a positive impact on revenue and growth?
I'm going to start with the way that I started, because the tech didn't exist to do it. And the technique that I learned had been invented actually before any of that existed. So the book I'm going to recommend to anyone that's it is The Strategy Focused Organization. The authors are Kaplan and Norton, Harvard Business Press. And yeah, it reads like a B school textbook, because it's probably what it was. But it's worth the slog, because what they came up with was a way to solve for a problem that I'll bet everybody listening right now has run into. And that is, a grand strategy is rolled out, the confetti falls, but before it's all swept up, most people couldn't tell you what the strategy was, right? The reason, according to these two professors, was that there was no measurement in place. So they came up with the concept of strategy mapping, where before you start executing, you map out the blocks of whatever your program is. For us, it's enablement. What are the building blocks of our enablement? And we're not ready for charters and frameworks yet. High level, 50,000 foot. What are the blocks of enablement that need to be put in place? But you map it using their technique back up to at least one of the company's top three revenue goals. And these are strategic level maps, so they should run your business. They typically should run for about 12 to 24 months, somewhere in there, right? So you shouldn't be reinventing them all the time. Then you've got those building blocks and you're showing correlation back up. And of course, you're working with your CRO, whoever you report to, make sure that they also agree with you. Now you can start to build the details, right? Well, what's the framework? What do we need to build to create that? But most importantly, the other side of Kaplan Norton's methodology is what they call the balanced scorecard. And for every block in your strategy map, you create a detail, you create a scorecard, and you map, what are we going to do this quarter for that element? Where are we today? Where do we need to be by the end of the quarter? What things are we specifically doing to get there? And at the end of the quarter, you're looking back and you're measuring. And if you're doing that consistently for every element of your map, you can't help but drive the strategy. Or you'll see that something's not working, you'll back up and you'll do it differently. So that's the way that I started doing it. And without tech or anything, it worked. It's not easy, but it worked really well. Now, the good news is, fast forward my last corporate job as VP at Instructure, we actually could buy an enablement platform that had that correlation built in. It was brilliant. So we'd have the pathways in there for, you know, the various development tracks that we would take people through in their career, and we could correlate that back directly to real-time results in Salesforce and scorecard it. Or excuse me, had a dashboard for it, right? Sure. But if you don't have the money, or right now is not the time to go out and roll out an expensive sales enablement platform, don't let that stop you, because that's my advice. There's really not a reason that anybody can't do it. And if you're an army of one, or you have a small team of three, you can still use that to be strategic and capture and measure what you're doing. Now, when you get to a chance to go into the QBR and you get to talk about things that the team have been doing, now you've got real facts and figures to refer to, not just whoever said it first, I don't know, butts and seats and smiley sheets, right? You move beyond the vanity metrics. And those are important leading indicators. If people don't show up for training, none of the other stuff's going to happen. But executives don't care. And so now you can walk in with real scorecarding and talk about impact.
I love that. I think when you and I met in Birmingham last year and we were sitting with Kate Lewis.
That was fun.
We were speaking to Kate Lewis of E for Enable. She puts it a very similar way to you. I think she puts it as, if you're talking about building your enablement programs, what are the top three things your CEO is worried about? Right.
Right. Like, and that's what your map's built around.
That's it, right? And I think is that's where everything in the company like goes from there. And even from there, you might have a sales and a, you know, retention just based on those priorities, right?
Right.
And I think also Ben Purton is a good way. I think I'm probably going to not do this verbatim, but his is like, what when he's talking about it, what percentage impact does your enablement team need to have in order to for you to see value in it? And for most of the time, it's 1%. Especially if you're at a big company, but any company, if you were to impact win rates by 1%, that's probably worth more. That amount of revenue is probably worth more than your entire team for a couple of years. Especially Ben's at Ring Central, right? So if he was to move them, they needed 1%, it's going to pay for his entire team for 5 years.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
But again, it's going back to, okay, so how much? What is important to you? And then I'll work from there. And again, one of the things we always talk about enablement is that ruthless prioritization. And I think if you have that conversation up front, to your point, is if someone comes with you at left field, you can go, well, I'm pointing at the North Star. This is not it. Right? I just want you to understand why I'm prioritizing this.
Yeah.
Have you seen that in real life, where you've been able to do that with the prioritization?
And sometimes the answer is still, yeah, but, right? Yeah, sure. So I'll give you an example. Last company where I worked, Instructure, my time there is almost 3.5 years. I think we did 6 acquisitions.
Wow.
And I was one of the leaders on the integration management office that helped bring those acquisition teams and integrate them. Enablement, that's another whole thing we should talk about. I can't think of a place where enablement has better opportunity to show value and contribution than helping an acquisition go through successfully in time to revenue, post-acquisition, time to revenue, enablement, big part of that. However, it's still very disruptive. Even with me being on the leadership level and knowing what was coming ahead of these acquisitions, it's still really disruptive. So here my team and I are chugging along, executing on our scorecard, executing on the things we said, and the company's just decided to go and make a $120 million acquisition, and there are going to be sales teams and CS teams, et cetera, coming with it. Yeah. All right, well, then, right. So there are times that you've got to be able to put a pin in it, step away, go do what you need to do, come back. But the key is the coming back. You've got that strategy map, you've got your scorecarding, and you've always got a center to return to. So to your point, there are times when you can show that and say, no, this is the course we're on. We've all agreed to it. That's very key. And here's what potentially will get disrupted or pushed off if we reprioritize. But you also sometimes, like I say, acquisition, the answer is still, yeah, but
of course,
this is coming. And so it can benefit you both ways. It can help you have that argument, but can also help you adjust when you need to for corporate initiatives that just have to be taken care of, right? But the biggest thing that I've seen the advantage, Kieran, is executives that you report to, they get it. They look at a strategy map like that. Number one, they may have come across the concept in school, depending on what their education background is. Sure. But even if they haven't, that's now you're meeting them where they are. When you start talking to them about elements of a strategy and how you're measuring those elements, they can get their head around that much more easily than the other stuff that I think we too often go in and try to talk about. That's the biggest advantage I see. And when you go to ask for money, I remember when I went to ask for about $400,000 at Instructure. I'd been there about a year. We needed some significant upgrades on some of our tech. I went in, and since my CRO was bought off on my strategy map, he knew how we were doing it. All I had to do was walk in and say, Frank, we need conversational intelligence. Here's what it is. Here's what it'll do. Here's why we need it. Here's the elements of the strategy map that will directly impact. And here's some modeling I've done with RevOps on what we think we could see in the first few quarters after implementing conversational intelligence. That's a much different pitch 100%. Than, again, what we're often trying to do when we're asking for money. And by the way, I got it. I got it for that, and I got it for the enablement platform I asked. But by tying it all back to the mapping that he'd already agreed made sense, it's an easier conversation.
Oh, 100%. No, I love that. Yeah. And it's that value piece. It's almost like, you know, that bit in 8 Mile. I don't know if you've seen 8 Mile, where he's like...
But 8 Mile, you're talking the...
The Eminem movie.
Eminem movie. Wow, that's been a while. Kim Basinger is the mother from... Yeah, right.
Yeah, he says all the things ahead of time so that no one's got anything to say. And it's like when you build around that, if you've got that signed off, you could be like, well, actually, you've got this, and this. And it's almost like it's more difficult to say no than it is to say yes. But just jumping on to the last question, I think this will be... You've given some really good tactical tips so far. This might be a mixture of sort of practical and tactical here. But... let's just say we've got some enablement leaders or enablement people in general listening into this. And if they are part of an enablement team, or if you lead an enablement team, and if they were to look at their current programs, what are the main telltale signs that will allow them to know whether they're focusing on customer journey enablement versus that quote-unquote traditional enablement?
If we're looking at it through the enablement lens, and I will stress again, make sure you've got a solid core for your sales teams. I wouldn't stray too far from that until you do, because that's the mistake I've seen some people take, is they try to take on too much at once, and that has its own problems. But look around for the things I was talking about. What is the churn rate, post-sales churn rate, as projects move through services and into customer success, right? Talk to your customer success teams. Because it's rare that the customer success teams ever talk to the same people that salesperson talked to who made the buying decision. Do the customer success teams have any clue why their clients bought this stuff? Do they have any clue what they are trying to do with it, what their outcomes are, right? Very basic things. If the answer is no, then you've got a big gap there. And those CSMs, I'm just picking on them as one example, not picking on them, but I'm choosing that as an example, that they're not being set up for success. If sales isn't sharing with them why people are buying the products, then it really is fluffy, as you said a few minutes ago. So those are some things. Just start asking questions and listening and see, are you seeing connections? Or are you seeing gaps?
Love that. No, I think that's great. I think even to one of the points you mentioned earlier, it's that language, right? If someone says, where are they in the process?
Yeah, like, where are they in the process?
Yeah, again, even like a slight shift from sales process to buyer process, or where, you know, again, even in discovery, you know, what's your buying process like for when you come, you're having for stuff like this. I think it just, again, it almost goes into that business acumen type, right? Of speaking their language, right? Like, help me understand how you make a decision rather than when can I get a decision on this, right? It's just, it's small bits, but it's vitally important. Well, Paul, I think you and I, if we stayed on this call, we could probably right all the wrongs of the world, especially in the neighbouring world. Ha. But unfortunately, we're out of time. So if anyone wants to hear more from you or get pick your brain or anything like that, where's the best place for them to get in contact with you?
I'm easy to find on LinkedIn. They can either book an appointment or just send me a DM. Either way, easy to talk to. If they're curious about what we're doing, revenueflywoodgroup.com. Certainly would show them that, but I'm always happy to hear from folks in the anyway. I love what we do, Karen. You know that. You do too. And we are all in it together. So yeah, let's all stay connected.
Absolutely. And as someone who has picked your brain, which has lots of knowledge and lots of experience in it, I can say that you're exceptionally open. And yes, I can say thank you for the information and advice you've given me. But that brings us to the end of another episode of Enablement Evolved. Paul, it was great to have you.
All right. Thanks, Karen.